The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
A very good day to you from me, Larry Neild, here on City Talk 105.9. I'm presenting The Commons Touch. It's our weekly look at politics. Well, it's been a busy week in the House of Commons with the mini-budget speech, and we're all going to be giving lots of money to spend for Christmas. I wonder what they're thinking about us over in Europe. My guest today is one of the Liverpool MEPs in the European Parliament, Chris Davis, former chairman of Liverpool Housing Committee, who has served on the City Council for quite a few years before he became an international politician. So it's a very good day to my guest, Chris Davis, the Liberal Democrat MEP for the Liverpool in the North West. Good afternoon, Chris.
Hi, good afternoon, Larry.
Chris, tomorrow we're seeing VAT reduced from 17.5% to 15%. I mean, this is, if you like, our membership fee for Europe. Is that a good thing?
Anything that ensures that we pay the debts necessary to cope with the financial crisis is a good thing. We have the leeway to do that, and VAT only pays a very small part of the total contribution we make to the European Union. Most of it comes out of general taxation, so it all goes into the melting pot, really.
I mean, in some states, it's over 20%, isn't it?
Well, VAT, yes. There's a leeway. I mean, there's a general recognition that VAT should not go below 5% in any case. That's the rock bottom minimum. But member states have a lot of discretion as to where they fix tax rates. Remember, on all these financial issues, tax above all, member states, individual governments have really the ultimate say. There's very little European unity on these issues.
Do you think that we're handling the economic crisis reasonably well here in the UK?
It's funny. I was just talking about that last night with a friend. What's ironic is that many of the problems of the financial crisis are those brought about as a result of government policy. Labour policy, following on from previous Conservative policy and just adapting it and strengthening it. That is things like not bothering too much about the regulation of the banks, saying it's, let it all hang out, let's everyone be free. And now we all realise that allowing debts to rise in the way they have, allowing a minimal regulation of banks, has been a catastrophic mistake. And it is the government's catastrophic mistake. And yet the action over the last few weeks from the government has given the impression that they know what they're doing and they're responding to a crisis and they're doing something. And I think people do look to governments to take action. So whatever the long-term consequences, in the short term at least, you respect the government for being seen to be doing something.
So do you see Gordon Brown, or should we call him Flash Gordon, saving the universe?
Undoubtedly, his reputation has changed dramatically over the last few months, simply by looking as though he is the captain of the ship, and when he pulls a lever, something happens. But in the long term, we could well find that the ship is sailing towards the iceberg.
Oh my God! Well, I hope not. I hope I'm not on board when it does that, Chris. Well, Chris, at this stage, we normally fire some questions at a guest. So you've been through this before. So if you're up for it, we're going to ask some questions. Is that all right?
Fire away.
Chris, let me ask you, what film would you watch more than once?
Local Hero.
Why is that?
I don't know, it's just pathos, really. It's the contrast between between commercial, business-orientated civilization, and yet different values.
What's your favourite political biography?
Roy Jenkins on Gladstone. Gladstone, of course, was born in Rodney Street in Liverpool, and I used to be a councillor. In fact, I've been a councillor for Rodney Street, and now I'm the MEP for the North West, which includes Rodney Street.
Well, that's good, yes. I suppose his house, has he got one of these plaques outside or something like that?
When I last saw it, it had a small and rather faded plaque, yes.
What's your favourite colour?
Purple.
Any reason for that?
I don't know. I'm wearing a purple shirt at the moment.
Oh, right.
Purple is a balance. And I once fought a by-election, a parliamentary by-election, more than 10 years ago, my party bosses sent me off to one of these places where they look at your colours and they give you a colour code and what colours work well and what don't. And the first thing the lady in charge said to me is, white does not do your skin any good at all. You look very old and grey when you wear white. So purple was one of the ones she recommended.
It's not because it's the corporate colour of Liverpool, the Lib Dem city here, is it?
I'd like to say there was some connection, but no, it simply makes me look less awful in the mornings than other colours do.
What political work, fact or fiction, would you like to send to a political foe?
Oh, wow. I suppose I wouldn't send Machiavelli, would I? Machiavelli's the prince. What work of fiction?
Or fact.
Or fact. Well, political foes. You know, I find in the European Parliament there were fewer and fewer political foes. There were simply people who take a different stance, whose opinions I can respect because they come from different national traditions or different political traditions. But very often we find ourselves working towards, you know, common goals. In my case, as an environmentalist, working to the goal of trying to stop the destruction of life on the planet and fighting climate change. I suppose I'd look at some of those members of the UK Independence Party who don't believe that climate change is taking place, or other climate change deniers, and I'd send them some books which simply illustrate the reality of the way in which the planet is changing and what it means if we don't bring it under control in the relatively near future.
Who influenced you in your life most, Chris? Your mother or your father?
My mother. Yeah, my mother.
Was she in politics?
No, never. But she's simply it's simply moral views, I suppose, and guidance, and what's right and wrong, and how you treat other people. I mean, I suppose part of my liberal philosophy, although others would say it's that part of their philosophy too, is simply, you know, and a religious philosophy: treat people as you would have them treat you.
Because your mother was a nurse, of course, wasn't she?
Originally, yes. But a long time ago, because she had to give up nursing when she got married. This is back in the 1940s.
How old were you when you first voted?
18. Just 18.
Just 18.
I was at university.
Was that in a local election?
It was in a local election, and I went in with the intention of voting Liberal, and on the ballot paper, there was just a Labour candidate and a Conservative candidate, and I felt mortified and pleased that that city, which is the city of Cambridge, has been in Liberal hands for decades since then. So obviously we made a dramatic transformation after my failed attempt to vote Liberal.
So who did you vote for in that one?
I voted Labour.
If you were a professional sports person, which sport would it be?
I won't say I'm professional, but I did win a £10 voucher in a fell race just last week. So my sport is fell running, that is hill running, mountain running in the Lake District.
If you could,
and I compete frequently, and I'm 54. I'm out next year. I've got when the current legislation I'm working on is out of the way, and I can get some more training in. I'm going out there to be the top over 50 fell runner in the country.
Wow! So you're going for the Guinness Book of Records, something like that?
No, I'm just going for my own niche sporting activity, which is to be the top over 50 mountain runner.
If you couldn't live in the UK, where would you choose to live?
Probably the Netherlands. I still, despite some of the difficulties they've had recently, and despite their appalling lack of hills, which would really hurt me a great deal, I find the Dutch just some of the most civilised, sensible, pragmatic, commonsensical people you ever likely to come across.
Do you think the UK will be dismantled during your lifetime?
Do I think the UK will be dismantled? No, I don't. Oh, well, that's a difficult one. I don't think England's going to break up, nor do I think England will part from Wales, though I think the Welsh Assembly will grow in powers. I would not bet that Scotland wouldn't become an independent nation within the European Union.
If there was a referendum on whether to stay in the EU or leave, how would you vote?
Well, without question, of course I'd stay. It would be ridiculous not to. I mean, the European Union consists of nothing more at heart than a mechanism which enables 27 governments to work together. I mean, the idea of pulling out and letting 26 other governments make the decisions about our part of the planet without us being there is just stupid.
Do you think if there was an international referendum across Europe, we'd stay in?
Oh yes, of course so. Because people care about issues, be it the current state of the economy, about the environment, about a whole range of social and other economic issues, and governments have to work together.
Do you think voting age should be lowered to 16?
I would have no objection to the voting age being reduced to 16. The difficulty would be getting any 16-year-olds to bother to vote.
Got to start sometime, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, frankly, you know, there is a perfectly good argument for saying so long as people are not under the influence of others, vote at any age. You know, if you do have some very opinionated 11-year-olds who are quite as capable of coming up with a political judgment as an opinionated 70-year-old. The majority simply wouldn't bother to vote. That's the reality.
I could just picture a political rally in a junior school. With people like you pleading for votes.
Well, why not? You certainly have mock elections, and I enjoy mock elections at schools.
Finally, Chris, let me ask you this. Who was your person of the 20th century?
You know, you've asked a number of questions about individuals here, and there is, you know, so individuals are so flawed, and that's no bad thing. I mean, I'm a flawed individual myself, so, you know, so I don't, but I don't really have heroes or people. I just think there are people who are, have been in the right time and the place, and sometimes others who've had the right views but haven't had the ability to communicate those. So I've got all sorts of people I look up to, every from Churchill to Gandhi to Lloyd George to, you know, Keynes and to a whole range of environmentalists. But there's no one individual that I would say is the person of the 20th century.
You're listening to the Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9 with me, Larry Neild. My guest is Chris Davis, the Liberal Democrat MEP for Liverpool and the North West. At the moment, you're pushing through some very important legislation in the European Parliament to do with the environment. Can you explain what it is?
I'm the Liberal Democrat environment spokesman in the European Parliament, and the work here is shared in a way that simply doesn't take place at the House of Commons. It's shared between the political parties on a proportional basis, and depending on the strength. We have a whole series of pieces of legislation on climate change now going through the Parliament, and I'm responsible for that, dealing with what's called carbon capture and storage, which is taking the carbon dioxide out of power stations, where it would normally be burnt and then thereafter emitted into the atmosphere, and piping it for long-term permanent storage deep down, perhaps a mile underground, in depleted gas or oil reserves. So with the oil and the gas has been used, it's been taken away. The rock, though, can still store the gas. And it's, you know, a coal-fired power station emits vast quantities of carbon dioxide. One new coal-fired power station, perhaps the one being proposed in Kings North in Kent, will emit more CO2 than is currently saved by every single wind farm in the country. So getting on top of this problem, what we do with our power stations, is hugely important. And especially if you want to bring in China and India and the United States, which are major coal users, and, you know, all that CO2 from their power stations rising. We've got to move towards technology where we don't simply take out, when we build a power station, the sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain, which we do now as a matter of routine and have done for the past 20 years, but we also take out the CO2 and bury it, buying us time, buying us decades in which to develop renewables and other forms of energy production, which won't cause harm to the environment.
What harm does the CO2 do to the environment?
Well, it's the single major global warming gas, simply because it's produced in such huge quantities. It's released by the burning of all fossil fuels. And the problem of global warming is that it traps, by trapping the Earth's warmth within the atmosphere, temperatures gradually rise, we bring about major changes in our climate, changes which will lead to the loss of water supply to billions of people across the planet, the inability of plants to grow because of the arid conditions, rising sea levels because of the melting of the ice caps.
Well, if we take it to a practical level, let's, for example, take Fiddler's Ferry Power Station, just on the outskirts of Liverpool. It's one of the biggest power stations in Europe, and it's a coal-fired station. How would they handle the CO2? What would they have to do?
You're talking probably about the next generation of power stations, probably a power station that will replace Fiddler's Ferry, because Fiddler's Ferry itself is getting quite old. When you build a replacement power station, assuming it's still a coal-fired one, then you'd install equipment which would either take the CO2 out after the coal has been burnt in the power station, before it's emitted into the atmosphere, or you do it probably before. You turn the coal into old classic Victorian coal gas. You separate the CO2 out at that stage and burn the gas to create the power. You collect the CO2, you pipe it off into the Irish Sea, and you'd almost certainly bury it down some of the depleted gas wells out in the Irish Sea around Morecambe Bay, or you can see the rigs from the coastline in places.
That would be a major engineering project, wouldn't it? It's a pipeline, underground pipeline from Fiddler's Ferry up to Morecambe and then out into the Irish Sea. That would cost a lot of money.
Yes, it would. But remember, as a result of the attempts to control global warming, we've now have the emissions trading scheme. And from 2013, all the power stations have got to buy carbon allowances for every tonne of CO2 they're going to emit into the atmosphere. This means that a nuclear power station, which doesn't emit CO2, will become relatively cheaper to operate, where coal-fired power stations, because of the emissions, will become more expensive. So it becomes more commercially viable for them to say, well, look, rather than buy these allowances and emit all the CO2, let's instead invest in this these pipelines and this separation equipment and bury the CO2 permanently.
If your legislation gets the go-ahead from the European Parliament, will it become law? I mean, will the power industry have to do this?
Yes, I mean, well... different stages here. The legislation we're steering through at the moment is intended to provide for the safe storage, to ensure there's no risk to anyone, to lay down those guidelines for European practice. Then my big initiative is to try and put in place the funding mechanism to get the first projects up and running, so we learn from our early mistakes, we develop the technology, we bring down the costs of it to make it possible to apply elsewhere. I'm trying to put in place at the moment a 10 billion euro funding package to get these first projects up and running. A few months ago, people said this was impossible. Now, I'm absolutely confident we'll at least put 5 billion up front, and we'll agree that within the next 2 weeks. And I hope we can get more, because, you know, this technology is of huge importance if we're really to get on top of this problem.
This is the Commons Touch with me, Larry Neild, on City Talk 105.9, the voice of Liverpool. I'll be back with more after this.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
Since 1992, North Mersey Business Centre has assisted the development of over 1,000 businesses with a high-quality, flexible approach to leasing. And now your organisation could benefit with business units available for rent at Knowsley Industrial Park. Our properties are available on monthly leases with no service charge added to our competitive rental costs. Lease with us and you'll even receive free parking and on-site security 24 hours a day. Join the long list of successful businesses at North Mersey Business Centre. Call today on 0151 549 1388.
Call Alpha, it's easy. If you really need to get from A to B, call Alpha, Taxi Heaven on 486-8797.
Clean, safe and reliable. Alpha cars are where you want, when you want them. 486-8797. Callback service now available.
Call Alpha on 486-8797.
Listen again to your favourite City Talk shows at citytalk.fm/citycasts. The voice of Liverpool, City Talk 105.9. The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
You're listening to City Talk 105.9 with me, Larry Neild, and this is the Commons Touch, our weekly look at politics. Recently you went to Palestine and you had a bit of a scary incident there, I read.
I'm a member of the Palestine delegation. All members of the European Parliament are linked up with one other parliament around the world. I'm linked up with the Palestinian Legislative Council, and so I visit Palestine usually once a year. The situation there is just dire. 4 million Palestinians under military occupation, under Israeli control. I always think, you know, what does military occupation mean? It means like having a foreign power controlling your city, controlling Merseyside. And they may not be there on a day-to-day basis, but any time they want, the soldiers can appear of a foreign power, can appear in the streets, can put blockades up in the streets to stop lorries and commercial activity, stop you getting to work, can arrest you arbitrarily. The situation is just appalling. I went there because there was a particular location near Jerusalem where the so-called separation wall is being built by the Israelis, which in theory divides Israel from the Palestinian territories, but in practice represents a big land grab with much Palestinian land being incorporated illegally into Israel, and most of the Palestinian West Bank's water supplies being incorporated into Israel. And here there's the location of this new security fence being built, not simply in defiance of international law, but in defiance at this location even of the Israeli Supreme Court, and I joined Israeli and Palestinian protesters against this action, a completely peaceful protest, and we were set upon by the Israeli Defense Force within minutes, with tear gas and then the soldiers coming and pushing us around and pushing some people to the ground. And previous incidents have involved people being killed at that location on previous demonstrations of this kind.
You were saying that they were pointing guns at the protesters.
Yes, and firing sound bombs and tear gas. And elsewhere, on other occasions, they've used rubber bullets, which have killed people.
And you were knocked to the ground. How did that happen?
Well, when 20 large IDF, Israeli Defense Force soldiers, come out and force you backwards down a gravelly slope without a degree of politeness, a number of people get knocked to the ground. It's almost inevitable.
But you weren't injured?
I got off very lightly. I mean, it's just interesting. Here they are, as I say, they're on Palestinian land here, in defiance of international law, in defiance of the Israeli Supreme Court. My big question to Israel was this. There is the talk about a two-state solution, and yet Palestine, the land that was Palestine at the time of the 1967 war, Palestine has been carved up. The Jewish settlements have been built in huge numbers all across it. Roads have been built over which connecting these settlements, which Palestinians aren't allowed to use. There were economic blockades all over the place to prevent the Palestinian economy growing in any sense at all. I don't know what Israel wants. How does Israel hope to have peace with its Palestinian neighbours unless it says what its boundaries are to be, where the border lines are to be, where the Palestinian state, if there is to be one, is supposed to start?
So when you read about road to peace, it's a very long road, isn't it?
It's almost an impossible one. I mean, I'm rapidly believing that a two-state solution is impossible, that you simply have to have a... Because of the facts on the ground having been changed, with all these new townships, these Jewish townships, and the wall and the roads and what have you, you're really looking for... You've got 4 million Palestinians living here. They have to be incorporated into a greater Israel, or a greater Palestine, if you like. And they should, of course, have equal rights. You can't have apartheid. But that threatens the Jewish nature of Israel. And if that happens, then it'll be brought about by the failure of Israel to define its own borders and to make it impossible for the creation of a Palestinian state, to bring it upon themselves.
Do you ever see the peace in the Middle East?
Yes, I do, and I think the hope is the so-called Saudi Arabian peace plan, where all 23 nations within the Middle East have said they will make perfect peace with Israel, so long as the Palestinian issue is resolved. For Israel, that really, instead of having to being surrounded by potential enemies, to be able to go into normal relations, as they already have with Egypt, with all their partners, would not only unlock the door to great prosperity, great economic prosperity for them, but also would take away so much grief, so much angst, and would, for the rest of us across the world, so much potential source of tension, which leads to terrorist incidents and an inflammation of tensions, which causes problems in so many ways.
Earlier this week, the Home Secretary in the House of Commons announced what was likely to be new rules that will virtually outlaw prostitution. You're saying that the police should protect and not persecute prostitutes.
Yes, I think the proposals from the Home Secretary are sheer madness. They're dressed up in the disguise that they're intended to stop the sexual trafficking of women, and who can dispute that? That would be a very, very good intention. But in practice, they're designed to prevent the oldest trade, that of prostitution. And it's simply impossible. What it will do, I think, is put women at greater risk in the long run. And certainly, it's really just a futile gesture, because most of the possible cases that could come to court could never be proven.
I mean, they're talking about doing this to protect women from, if you like, pimps who are very cruel, beat women up and force them into a life of the sex trade, as it were. But you don't see it like that, do you?
No, I don't. I think if you look at the situation in the Netherlands and the situation in New Zealand, where sex trade has been brought into the open, women are in a much better position to protect themselves, to work together. and to ensure that they don't come to harm and to free themselves from the involvement of pimps. But the sex trade is said to involve 80,000 people, and the vast majority of those, I would suggest 75, 80, 85, maybe even 90% of sex workers are there because they see it as a legitimate activity. This may not be their first choice, but it's one which clearly pays well by comparison to other economic choices. And I think the feminist approach that somehow this is all about female exploitation, it misses the mark. Most of the women working in this trade, and I work with the English Collective of Prostitutes and its European equivalent on some of these issues, they would say this is a free choice for people. And what we need is the industry, if you like, the business, to be legitimised. They may not be very keen on paying taxes, but I would say that has to be part of the process, should be regulated, taxed, legalised, and the police should be there to protect prostitutes and not to persecute them.
This is Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. In the House of Lords this week, the good old peers supported the proposal to upgrade cannabis to make it a tougher sentence for people caught in possession of cannabis. I mean, you were fined once, weren't you, for carrying cannabis?
Yes, I made a political protest. I've never taken any illegal drug, but I made it. I think the laws on our drugs are just ludicrous. I made a political protest outside Stockport Police Station some 5 years ago when I held up a small bit of cannabis on the back of a postage stamp and at the end of the day got fined a couple of hundred pounds and about £5,000 worth of expenses because they wanted to make an example of me. But the laws are just nonsense. Cannabis, remember, some 100,000 people a year still die prematurely of smoking-related diseases. Some 25, 30,000 of alcohol-related diseases. And from cannabis, no one, absolutely no one, dies in history of the world. There's been a couple of instances of people apparently dying from cannabis and cannabis use alone, and yet we criminalise it. We make people into criminals, and we put, as a result of the fact that the distribution of this drug is outside the law, we end up putting vast profits into the hands of organised crime, often into the hands of people who have a commercial interest in getting people to try a different and more addictive and much more dangerous drugs. I just think the whole approach is nonsense. And to fly in the face of the scientific evidence, which said that cannabis should be downgraded, and that ever since it was downgraded, the number of people taking it has gone down, just seems to me to make no sense at all. It's simply trying to appease the editorial writers.
Well, because the government, of course, are saying that there are grave mental health risks from cannabis use, particularly if people use the stronger varieties.
Well, the government has an advisory body called the Advisory Council on Drugs Misuse, and it found that although it was true that skunk seemed to be being used in much greater quantities than had been the case in previous decades, the link between mental health and cannabis use was minimal. You're talking here about perhaps 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 2,000 people who may have mental problems in the first case. I find that those mental problems are increased as a result of the use of cannabis, although indeed they could have been increased by the use of alcohol or some other stimulant. In a free society, people have got to be allowed to make decisions for themselves, and it should be the job of government to give them as much health information as possible so they can ensure that those decisions are based on good information, have a good factual basis. The decisions they make should have a good factual basis.
So how should people be able to get their hands on cannabis if you liberated the law?
Well, personally, I'd set up a licensing and regulation regime. You can take the example of the coffee shops in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, if you like. But actually, I'd go through a series of registered outlets where cannabis would be available, subject to proper identification procedures, and the whole object would be to undermine the criminal market. I don't see why we should be perpetuating laws, the main purpose of which is to put billions and billions of pounds into the hands of some very nasty people.
I noticed, Chris, that you've come to the aid of our near relatives, the apes. You want to ban experiments on primates, our close relatives, as I say.
Well, I'm pleased to say that, so far as the great apes are concerned, there are relatively few experiments taking place. But and of course the great apes are endangered in so many ways. The idea of using them for medical experiments seems simply appalling. So I think we do need to put an absolute prohibition on routine experimentation on great apes, which are simply biologically so close to ourselves. Sometimes it feels like we're allowing experimentation on children, for example. Not quite akin, but just unacceptable.
I was reading one of your reports, and you were saying that across Europe every year 1.2 million animals, and mainly rats and mice, are used in experiments. It's a lot of animals there, isn't it?
It is, but much progress has been made since we introduced new cosmetic legislation back in about 7 or 8 years ago. Where we introduced a ban on the use of animals in cosmetic testing, some of which those prohibitions are just coming into force now, and there's some more in the pipeline. But it really led to the industry putting more money into the investigation and development of alternative testing methods, which don't require the use of animals. And there's a whole series now of alternative tests which have been validated, which can now be used, and which we have to make compulsory. Their use has to be compulsory, as distinct from the testing of animals, wherever that's possible. But unfortunately, there are other tests where the alternatives are not yet there. So I'm not against the idea of animal testing, where it can help save human life. We just need to ensure that at the earliest possible opportunity, we need to phase it out, and that means that we need to put money into investigating and developing the alternatives.
Well, isn't one of the dangers, Chris, that if Europe prohibits or restricts animal experimentation, the research work will just move to parts of the world where the welfare of animals isn't even taken into consideration?
Yeah, that's always a danger, but one of the great advantages of the European Union is that we have a single market. We control the standards of every product made in the European Union and every product that can be imported into the European Union. So in the case of cosmetics, the legislation we have introduced applies also to imported products too. So It's one of the tools we can use to raise standards elsewhere. People want to sell into the European Union. It's the biggest single economic market in the world, and therefore they have to meet the standards we set if they want to make some money out of us.
So how do you think this law would proceed in future? I mean, will we eventually see a complete ban on animal experiments?
Well, one day perhaps, but we're not there yet. And in fact, as a result of the legislation which I had a part in playing, the new chemical legislation designed to ensure that we're not releasing into the environment chemicals which might cause long-term problems for health or the environment, the actual testing requirements have increased of late. Because there's just simply so many chemicals, and so little is known about many of the ones we use on all too routine a basis.
Next year, Chris, we've got the European elections. Do you think we're ready for it? Are we going to vote in our millions?
We'll be lucky if we vote in our hundreds, I think. I mean, the European elections are the most boring elections known to mankind. And the reason for that is if you go and vote in a local council election, you are at least voting for who's going to run the local council. And if you vote in the general election, you are going to vote for who's going to run the country. But when you vote in the elections for the European Parliament, all you're doing is voting for a change in the balance of representatives in a parliament which is only one-third of the European Union decision-making process. Because laws in the European Union are proposed by the European Commission, which has been set up to do that job. They then have to be ratified both by the ministers, our ministers and all the other ministers from across Europe, and by the European Parliament. But you don't get a chance to vote for the ministers. That's done by national parliaments. And you don't get a chance to vote for the Commission. So, not surprisingly, people say, well, why bother? I, of course, want to make them as interesting as possible, and I care passionately about my work, and I have to say that as a parliamentarian, who's been in the House of Commons too, it is hugely more valuable to be in the European Parliament. You have a great deal more influence over the making of legislation than you do in the House of Commons, where everything's controlled by the government. But, that's not... Why the voters should be interested in that rather than the politicians, I don't know.
So what was the turnout last time? Was it 30, 40%? Or I can't remember.
It was higher last time because we had local elections on the same day. Next year we won't have local elections on the same day, except on Merseyside or in Greater Manchester. And I wouldn't be surprised, I'm afraid, if turnout was in single figures in parts of Liverpool.
And yet the European Parliament or the EU, has a very, very big influence on the lives of everybody in the United Kingdom, across Liverpool, across Merseyside, and indeed across Europe. It's incredible that we shouldn't want to have our voice heard.
Well, the Parliament is only one third of the EU decision-making procedure. The minister, I'm doing battle at the moment with ministers over the legislation I'm trying to put into practice. Because on a number of issues, ministers don't want to go as far or spend as much money as I want to see spent to reach the goals as quickly. So there were different ways of influencing the EU. It is after all, at heart, the EU is a mechanism which enables governments to work together. And the elected process, it involves the ministers working together. They get outside advice, if you like, from the Commission, and a good European steer from the Commission. And they get a bit of democratic involvement from the directly elected European Parliament. But who pulls the strings? It's a negotiation. It's constant negotiations, and it's very difficult to say to someone, you vote this way in a European election and that will happen. You can't promise that's going to be the case.
I think one of the problems, of course, is that the EU, for whatever reason, has generated a lot of adverse, if you like, comical publicity with some of its bizarre rules and directives.
And yet, whenever people want something doing, so often I have people coming to me who say, well, you know, can't you get Europe to do this? And sometimes I say, well, no, because I don't think it's Europe's responsibility to do that. Someone came to me just recently saying, we want protection for caves. We want European protection for caves. Now, I can argue that if caves protect unique habitats, protect unique forms of life, then there's an argument under European environment legislation for an EU role. But caves? I mean, it's got to be member states. And yet, you know, someone who may be a Eurosceptic the rest of the time cares passionately about caves and wants European protection. And a few years ago, when the beef farmers were complaining about France not allowing our beef into their markets, I had a meeting with beef farmers, and they were telling the European Commissioner in front of us, do something. And he was saying, I've done everything I can. I've written the French authorities a letter saying they're not sticking to the rules. And the farmers were going mad. You say, what do you mean a letter? And he laid it down. He said, you know, I'm a European Commissioner. I do not have an army. I do not have a police force. We are lawyers. You know, we send letters to each other, and eventually we go to court in order to get agreement. These are governments working together. You know, where this idea of the super state comes from is, it's just a myth.
So you don't think we'll ever have a United States of Europe?
In the way that, not in my lifetime. We may get closer involvement of the governments working together for common interests, and I think that's a good thing. This is a world, remember, which is growing by 1.5 million people every single week. 150,000 people, the size of Liverpool, every 3 days. The world is changing hugely fast, and the problems we face are major and are shared, and we need common solutions. We need to work with our partners, other countries around us, in order to develop those solutions. Because increasingly, as the population grows, Britain becomes smaller and smaller, relatively speaking, with each day, and relatively speaking, has less and less influence.
This is Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch. I've been talking to Chris Davis, the Liberal Democrat MEP for Liverpool and the North West. I'll be back with more after this.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9. The Duncan Barks Show.
Monday morning from 9 o'clock, it appears we are now offering prisoners the chance to participate in IVF treatment. And as ever, you and I will be picking up the tab. I thought prison was supposed to be a loss of liberty. I don't want my tax to be used to fund IVF treatment for people who have committed a crime against society. Do you? And everyone has one. So what's your karaoke classic?
The Duncan Barks Show.
Weekdays from 9 a.m.
on City Talk 105.9.
Because we know our listeners have impeccable taste, we at City Talk 105.9 have arranged half-price vouchers for 12 of the region's classiest restaurants. Let's get talking taste.
River Bar and Grill offers continental style, modern menus designed by an award-winning chef, and most of all, a touch of class. With an eclectic range of delicious foods, River Bar and Grill is sure to appeal to any palate, from the gourmet burger lover to the more adventurous diner. Fully licensed with Outdoor Terrace, this is a restaurant you'll return to time and again. And from 8 a.m. this Thursday, you can get a £50 voucher for River Bar and Grill for just £25 at citytalk.fm. But you'll have to be quick. With only a limited number available, once they're gone, they're gone.
Talking Taste, exclusive to City Talk 105.9.
This is The Commons Touch.
The Commons Touch.
On City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back. This is Larry Neal on City Talk 105.9 with The Commons Touch. Well, earlier I was talking to Chris Davis, the Labour MEP for Liverpool and the North West, and now joined by Chris Burgess from the Federation of Small Businesses here on Merseyside. Well, Chris, we've got VAT going down tomorrow. I bet you're thrilled, aren't you?
Absolutely wonderful.
Is it that good? I mean,
no, it's not. They were one of the, it's good in as much as it's gone down, but the original VAT was about 12.5% in the 70s.
It was 8%.
Oh, yeah. Yes, but that was only for certain items. And the majority of it was higher than that. Then it went up at one time to, I think...
15?
25. They were muted to do it. I don't know whether it was knocked in the head or everybody.
I think you're going back to post-war purchase tax, aren't you, with 25%?
No, what happened is because they were going to put it up to 17.5%, they put it out there that they were going to put it up to 25%. So it frightens everybody, so then they settle for 17.5%. Very cleverly done. And we've had it ever since.
Well, Chris Davis was saying that in some European states, it is more than 20%.
Yeah, well, at one time in Southern Ireland, for an example, I think the luxury goods were 50% VAT. This is many years ago now, because I am very old, Lenny.
But, I mean, seriously, for small businesses, will 2.5% off make any difference at all?
Not a great deal, no. Because it's not a large amount of real money in cash terms.
I mean, we've had this week Woolworths going to the wall where they're still trading, thank God, and let's hope they survive. And we've now got the big furniture, MFI. Mm. I get them mixed up with MI5, I don't know which is which. But anyway, MFI.
You get an answer off at MI5.
But the thing is that these are, you know, big high street giants that are struggling in the credit crunch. It really is going to get worse before it gets better.
Yeah, well, one of the things now, you've got to be slick and really on the ball in business and give the customers what they want. MFI, unfortunately, over a period of years, it was, you go into the shop, if you wanted a bed, it'll be a month's. Well, with all due respect, you're going to sleep on the floor for a month. So
you wanted today, really, didn't you?
It was that kind of thing. Everything they did was 6 weeks delay, 8 weeks delay. You can't, over a long period of time, you can when there's boom times on because you get enough customers. But the percentage that walk away, you can't afford to lose them now.
But the problem is, Chris, with these businesses, these big businesses, it's like cash flow problems, isn't it? And this is what it's all about. And that applies, we've talked about the effect of cash flow on small businesses, but it happens to the big guys as well.
Oh, yeah. What happens is in a time of good times, if they're not given really good service, because of the advertising with the big organisations and the name, they'll have sufficient business to keep them going. With a small business, it never works like that. If you don't supply the customers with the goods on time and give them a good service, you go pop. In times of recession, what happens, the banks don't look kindly on small businesses. They pull the money back off them instead of giving them a buffer to carry on.
Well, I remember talking to a manager from one of the retail parks on Merseyside, and they had a big unit there, and they moved out because the owners were going to double the rent from £500,000 a year to £1 million a year one go. Mm. And I thought, you've got to sell a lot of goods just to cover your rent, never mind your wages and all that lot. I don't know how these people survive.
Well, again, it's all based on turnover. If, for example, you turn over millions and millions of articles, you can make a lower percentage profit margin and still survive. Now, some of these discount organisations, like, for example, Currys and PC World and so on and so forth, they go on volume sales and low prices, so therefore the profit margin isn't all that high.
But they need to sell a lot, don't they?
They need to sell a lot. So in a downturn, they're going to be struggling. So I would look at the retail game and the electronics business, for example, and also the telephones. And I think you'll see quite a few of them either amalgamating, being bought out by other organisations, or going to the wall in the next 18 months.
Well, one of the things that Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, was saying this week, Chris, was that the money will start to flow soon into the pockets, well, not the pockets, but the businesses, small businesses, to ease the problems that they're getting. I still don't think it's happening quick enough, though.
No, we're lobbying, the FSB are lobbying the government and having round-table meetings with them to gee the banks up to actually do that. Now, the banks have, say, for example, the banks have got 50 billion quid that's been given to them by the government. If they sit on that for 3 months, it earns them a lot of interest wherever they've stashed it. So, therefore, same old, they're hanging on to the money. They're probably earning interest on the international markets, and it's not going out to the small businesses, specifically this £1 billion that they set aside for SMEs. And it's not coming through yet. A couple of the banks are pretty good, which will be nameless, and quite a few of the banks are absolutely blooming abysmal.
I better not name them either, Chris.
Of course not.
I'll tell you what the Federation, your organisation, should do. It should collate a list of the companies that have gone belly up because of cash flow problems and banks, if you like, pulling the plug. Mm. And they should list the banks that those companies banked with and, if you like, have a list of shame.
Yeah, I mean, that is it's a good idea, Larry. I mean, in actual fact, they are compiling lists of people who were struggling anyway. We did have a thing that we sent out, which there will be an update on that. This is over the last 12 months. Who was struggling, who was down on turnover, and so on and so forth. They could do something on the bank. One of the things with naming and shaming, individual branches of banks could be named and shamed, but the overall effect for the bank in general could be slightly different. In other words, you could have a couple of banks in a chain of 100, and a couple of banks are real, not nice.
But the point I'm making is that if the banks know that they will be called to account one day, because the dust will settle on this, you know, economic crisis that we're in, and things will start to get back to normal. Mm. Now, it will be good to know, in 08, who were the good guys and who were the bad guys. And I think people would willingly vote with their feet in that time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you could take it like that. But the only thing is, what you've basically got to understand is the banks do not care. It's not that the bank people and the staff don't care, because they're taking the sort of backlash all the time on the desk. But the people at the top do not care. Barclays Bank, for example, have just gone to one of these Arabian sort of, or Middle Eastern banks to give them the money instead of going to the government. That's so Barclays Bank can say to the government, well, we're not in your scheme, so we will trade as we wish, which is fine with a limited company. But they haven't been given this handout from the government then. So
they didn't want it?
They didn't want it because if they wanted it, they'd have to, I presume, because obviously I wasn't in on the negotiations, they would then have to toe the line, as the government says, give this money out to small businesses in such and such a manner. Now, they wish to continue in their mode, that's fine. They're a public limited company. They can do what they want for the shareholders with no restrictions by the government, because they didn't go into the scheme, up to date anyway.
Well, I'll have a word with Mr. Barclay when I next see him. Well, pop into his
bench. God bless you, my child. Hope he loans you a few bob.
Well, I'm not sure about that, Chris. Mm. You're listening to The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9 with me, Larry Neild. And I'm talking to Chris Burgess, chairman of the Merseyside branch of the Federation of Small Businesses. Chris, let me ask you this. We kicked off a debate on City Talk this week. Mike Storey, the Deputy Lord Mayor, was one of the guests here earlier this week, saying that we should use the name Liverpool as a brand name to promote Merseyside around the world. And he really did set the cat among the pigeons. But I'll tell you something. I fully agree with Mike Storey, because I've been saying for years that we should brand Liverpool as if you like, the economic powerhouse of Merseyside. What do you think?
Yeah, spot on. Liverpool is a internationally renowned city from donkey's years ago. We've had our downs, but the main thing with the Liverpool, if you like, capital culture or dynamic city, is the people. You cannot suppress the Liverpool people. They'll come bouncing back every time. It is a great city. Whether you would call it Great Liverpool, I wouldn't go for that.
Grand Liverpool is one of the suggestions.
What a load of... Well, never mind, but Liverpool. What do you need the grand for? We know we're grand.
Well, because you've got to differentiate between Liverpool as a city and the Liverpool city region, which takes in the neighbouring boroughs.
No, just call it Liverpool.
But the thing is that nobody's suggesting that Liverpool will run Wirral or will run Sefton or St Helens or Knowsley or Holton. What the, you know, because if you go along the M62 to Manchester, the economic structure uses the Manchester brand name for the great of Manchester. Yeah. So Wigan gets branded as Manchester, well, they love it.
Yeah, the latest city or governmental type bureaucratic thinking now is that the cities are the drivers of the regions.
Oh, they are.
They always have been. It's just that you get this daft blinking messing around where they change the boundaries for political reasons instead of, outside of the Liverpool boundary being called Lancashire, it's now called Merseyside. And why they changed it was political reasons for voting or whatever. Liverpool has always had that name.
But if you go anywhere around the world, Chris, and you say we're here to promote Liverpool, the people in any country in any continent will instantly know what area of Britain you're talking about.
Yeah.
If you go and say we're here from Wirral. They don't even know what country it's in, what planet it's on.
Have a clue.
Oh, Knowsley or Sefton. And that's no disrespect to them.
No, well, the spin-off from advertising Liverpool, if you like, is a brand name and pushing the Liverpool, come to Liverpool. The spin-offs are for Southport, the Wirral,
of course.
Golf courses,
well,
so on and so forth.
Why can't they see that? Because people were ringing the station up saying, you know, we live on the Wirral. We don't live in Liverpool. We don't want to be part of it. Remember a few years ago, there was a campaign to get rid of the L postcodes from Wirral because they didn't want to be associated. Mm. They were saying, we are Cheshire. And I would have said, okay, you can go to Cheshire. What we're going to do, we're going to brick up the Mersey Tunnel. Stay over there. Get your jobs over there.
Yeah, well, it's parochial, you see. People always want to defend what they've always had.
But they could still do that.
Oh, no, but it's funny, Larry. You know that with people. Of course they could still do it. In other words, we had the international golf tournament in the Wirral. Well, you know... We're not moaning and bellyaching because it wasn't classified as Liverpool. But the spin-offs is people coming to the city of Liverpool when they go to the Gulf. So, fine.
Well, I know. I mean, if we'd have said to the organisers of the Wirral Open, if you're going to call it the Wirral Open, you're not going to use our hotels in Liverpool. You know, stay over there. They would have had to have tented cities over there, wouldn't they, to put up the guests?
That would have been nice.
It would have been nice. On the beaches.
I could have got my camel out.
Well, whether it will ever change, I don't know. I do think that we suffer greatly in this area from the tribal rivalry of our individuality.
The tribal rivalry is mainly at the bureaucratic level, is because they're all trying to get money out of the same pot, and they think if Liverpool get X amount of money, that will detract from the amount of money they can get in, say, St Helens or Sefton, and it's not really so, but they're just fighting for survival.
But
instead of joined up thinking.
Well, let's take Liverpool City Centre. 80,000 people work in Liverpool City Centre. It's the biggest employer in the sub region.
Yeah.
Of that 80,000, nearly two thirds are not from Liverpool. They're from Wirral and Sefton.
Yeah.
So if Liverpool City Centre, if Liverpool is that dynamic hub and creates more jobs.
Yeah.
Two-thirds of those jobs will go to Wirral and Knowsley and St Helens and wherever.
Of course
and you're thinking, well, why can't they see that? Because if you live in Wirral and work in Liverpool...
Well, it's like, this is how clever we were donkeys years ago. We actually built a canal to Manchester. And that was the daftest thing we ever did for Liverpool, when you look at it in this generation. Because we opened up Manchester up as a really trading city, mainly because of the mills and so on, which was cotton then. Whereas now... They've got their act together. They're not fighting each other within the area, and they push Manchester as the badge name, if you like, the logo.
Well, you're listening to Larry Neild on City Talk 105.9 with the Commons Touch, broadcasting from Grand Liverpool or Great Liverpool or
Liverpool. Just Liverpool. I love the place.
I've been talking to Chris Burgess, from the Federation of Small Businesses. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thanks very much.
And thanks earlier to Chris Davies, the Labour MEP for Liverpool and the North West. I'll be here at this time next week. Have a very good afternoon and bye-bye.
The Commons Touch on City Talk 105.9.
Across Merseyside
on 105.9 FM
and DAB Digital Radio.
This is City Talk.
This hour, investigation after blast destroys flats.
City Talk
News.
Good afternoon, it's 1 o'clock. Two people are critically ill in hospital after an explosion destroyed a block of flats in Wigan. The front of the building was blasted out and the top two floors collapsed in the Worsley Mains area last night.
Just shook our conservatory, it went bum, 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 bum. We went running in the back garden to have a look.
I just knew it was an explosion from our house where the conservatory door sucked in. Well, what you can see there, there's a building missing.
Well, it took